How about we don't try and make food perfect? Because it's not perfect, just like life's not perfect.
If you're recycling, that's awesome. But you also need to look at all these other pieces, and you don't have to be doing them perfectly.
The first step is reduce, then reuse, then recycle. They are in order.
Get inspired by people fighting to make this world better for everyone. This is Unwasted with Imperfect.
Hello and welcome back to the Unwasted podcast. I'm your host, Riley Brock, and it's my honor every week to talk with experts in food, health, sustainability, and generally making the world a better, tastier place. Does environmentalism have a racism problem? Is veganism elitist? Why do so many young environmental activists suffer from burnout? These are just some of the thorny but important issues that today's guest fearlessly tackles every day. He's an educator and speaker who's passionate about environmental justice, veganism, and zero waste. And I'm honored to have him with us here today. Isaias Hernandez, welcome to the podcast.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me today, Riley.
It's a real pleasure. I always love talking to communicators like you. It strikes me that you have a very unique tone in the content you put out, which I really like and find really thought-provoking. You know, as an example, your Instagram is populated with really fascinating kind of thought starters, you know, questions about the environment, like, are influencers destroying national parks for a photo? What is petro-masculinity? How did the Grinch almost save the planet? And is dismantling white supremacy a form of environmentalism? And I honestly, I'll be honest, I spent a while just looking at these questions and reading through the comments and reading through your captions about them. And it strikes me that you take just a really thoughtful approach to all of these issues. So I'm curious to hear, to start off with, you know, how would you describe your approach to environmental topics?
Yeah, definitely. I think as a visual learner for me growing up, I'm really emphasized on color coding notes, and that's how it really helped me get my degree at the end of the day. When presenting content online, I realized that around 40 to 50% of the human population are visual learners, whether it be through illustrations, graphics, or video content. And so for me, when I really plan this content out, I really look into things that I've been discussing in my own life. And so how I continuously learn about environmentalism is having open discussions with my community, but also challenging myself to rethink the ways, because when I insert my own feelings and perspectives on said subject or said topic, I really want people to critique me. I want people to critique the ideas that I forgive or put on the table. And this is what I think environmental education encompasses, is a holistic view of different perspectives and from different types of marginalized identities in the environmental movement. And so this is something that it really motivates people to do, because you don't learn this in your traditional classroom settings. And these topics aren't really talked about because they're not seen as really relevant or important for the professor's curriculums.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's really fascinating, the approach you take, in part because, you know, I think in this day and age, we're all surrounded by clickbait, right? And these thought-provoking questions. And so at first, when I saw your page, I was wondering, like, is that the approach he's taking? And yet when I dug deeper, it seems like what you brought up is really important, that you actually really enjoy the back and forth and the debate, not just to like win an argument or say, look, I've got this counterintuitive view that you don't, and like, look at me. It's more about what you said, like, how can we circle these issues and kind of understand them from different sides that maybe you haven't thought of before?
Yeah, definitely. And I think it's a really great opportunity too for a lot of people that may have had these preconceptions of certain topics. And I think this is what is about learning, and unlearning is a horrible, ugly process sometimes, but it's also very liberating, because you get to realize some certain of the biases that you carry that you may have not noticed, or you may have really lived in your own experiences. And while we all have privileges in life, in society, all of us, no matter who we are, I think it's also important that we also hold space for those that may not have the privilege or the opportunities to share their thoughts in societal levels, or whether it be through inside digital spaces.
Yeah, it strikes me that you're kind of broadening the lens of what an environmental discussion looks like, which I think is pretty cool and pretty important. Like, we need that, in that, you know, I think when you hear about environmentalism, a lot of us think solar panels, how do we protect watersheds, let's talk about endangered species. But on your page, you know, there's stuff talking about white supremacy, we're talking about influencer culture, we're talking about masculinity and gender, and these are, to a lot of folks, I think these are newer concepts to hear in an environmental discussion. Where did this approach come from to kind of like bring in make environmentalism a bit more interdisciplinary and inclusive?
Yeah, definitely. I think it has to stem from my passion to learn about different subjects. Always, even in universities, while I was studying environmental science at Berkeley, I remember just being involved in different types of industries, whether it be the creative industry, whether it be the social media industry. And, you know, I took courses on LGBTQ studies. I took courses on racial, ethnic, identities and things like that. And so it really made me realize that there are so many interlaps and interconnections between education and environmentalism that kind of provides these types of terms. And so I think people that are very involved with heavy sciences, with environmentalism, conservation has always been a huge focus. It's always been the forefront. I did research on it. And so I completely understand the importance of it. But I think that what really makes people interested to learn more about the environment, because we all have different ways of how we learn and how we attract ourselves to certain subjects. And so my goal as an environmental educator is to inspire and empower one person to kind of actively think about these things. And so if they're not able to really make those interconnections, it's fine. But I think that presenting the topics to their favors, whether it be the fashion industry, whether it be the video game industry, whether it be, other types of industries that they really are passionate about, it's all rooted in environmentalism at the end of the day. And so that's my main mission, is to encourage people to reconnect with those roots, to get to that very deep issue of what we're living today in our ecological crisis. And so as a global educator, I guess you would say, and covering all these topics, I've been very inspired by both academics, that scholars that I've read in college, and also two cultural-based experiences, and three also personal lived experiences, whether it be through my experiences of research or even knowing the community and meeting other climate organizers and climate activists.
Awesome. And, you know, you touched on it a bit, you know, in school, yeah, like you said, environmentalism talks a lot about conservation. You know, what's something you think environmental education gets right about the environment, and what's something you think it gets wrong or kind of misses the mark on?
Yeah, you know, I think with environmental education, when it talks about the sciences, whether it be through the cycles, whether it be through the processes, I think that is correct. I think scientifically, we should all be learning about science, and it's very good and it's very valid. I think the issue is the fact that what I've seen is what they do wrong is kind of placing the narrative of climate change and climate crisis into, you know, when I was younger growing up, it was almost seen as an othering, or it was almost seen as something that was like opposite, or seen as like, I guess you would say, not really like an othering. Hmm. And I think climate crisis is such a complex issue that we need to look into it from a more personal lens. And so teachers and educators that teach about environmentalism, we need to start having discussions out of like, what do we do when our houses are burning? What do we do when we're experiencing flooding? Right now, even in institutions, they don't even know how to handle the ecological crisis with students. You know, when there's a wildfire in Northern California, like, what do you do as an institution? Do you continue to operate, or do you lose thousands of dollars? And so what we see now is that these systems that were in place to teach these educational empowerment things for people, that they're not really sufficient for marginalized communities, and they don't serve them. And so This is why you see so much disconnect with the environmental movement. And although research like conservation has proved itself to be very extensive, very profitable, or what you would say, scalable, environmental justice, environmental racism, those topics are not really valued at a high in academic fields. And that's because scientists don't really see the value of it, even though they recognize and acknowledge it, but they don't see it as a very long-term research base. And so this is why we have an issue with environmental education, that is that it fails to provide cultural experiences, indigenous wisdom and knowledge, and also empower individuals to validate their lived experiences as a form of environmentalism.
Hmm. Yeah, in a way, it kind of, correct me if I'm wrong, it kind of sounds like environmentalism too often leaves out the people. Like, we're talking so much about these abstract environments, but what about the people that have lived there, do live there, might live there one day? What are their experiences like? Are we doing a good job at helping them? Are they being totally left out of discussions, policy decisions? Yeah, that's super interesting. You know, when we're talking about the environmental movement and race and gender, kind of, it seems like you have some strong thoughts and takes on this. I'm curious, you know, what are some of the blind spots you've seen around race and gender in environmentalism?
Yeah, I think for me is the fact that there is this rhetoric of the environment can't be racist. That's not possible. Mm-hmm. And that, I guess, is a fact. The environment isn't racist, but the people in power, the policies, the institutions that decide these types of policies and practices does affect marginalized communities of color. Yep. And that's the issue. And if we look into the long history of systemic racism and decades of redlining done on low-income communities of color that have been pushed out due to many affluent neighborhoods not wanting these types of people, you get this question of like, who was here first, the chicken or the egg, the industry or the community? And so regardless if the industry was first or the community was first, everyone should have access to clean air, water, and soil, no matter who you are as a human being. And that's just not the case for anywhere globally in the United States or outside when it comes to Black, Indigenous people of color. And, you know, we spent so much time, talking about conservation, protecting ecosystems. But like you mentioned, we forget the people who have always been there and trying to protect the land and have been murdered or been harmed by institutions of power or development agencies that do not want Indigenous communities to continue protecting their ecosystems. And so I think that those are some of the errors and some of the spots that we see, but also there is a lack of acknowledgement for people to dedicate their lives to become anti-racist and to learn the historical complications of racism that has inflicted on BIPOC communities. And that is something that is not a controversial topic. It is history. It happened, but it's not something of the past because it still manifests itself in different forms today.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, we had Leah Thomas on the podcast, another fellow environmental educator. And something she said that really stuck with me was how heartbroken she felt that environmentalists she knew and respected would stand up for a salmon's life, but wouldn't stand up for a Black life that was being threatened. You know, there was this weird, not even a double standard, just this total disconnect of, yeah, I will protest the building of a dam that will affect some salmon. But when it comes to things that are racial and having impacts on people, not fish, it's suddenly off the table or it's not an environmental issue, which is, that really stuck with me. That's a really poignant disconnect, it seems like, in the movement as a whole.
Definitely. Yeah, it's a huge issue. And I would hope that, you know, those who've been protesting development projects and some of those in the Indigenous communities understand the intrinsic life for the justice of life for all beings in those environments. And that's something that is often disconnected here in the West a lot.
Yeah. You know, a term I saw a lot in your content that I learned a ton as I dug into it was frontline communities. Can you explain a bit about what is a frontline community when we're talking about environmentalism?
Yeah. You know, it's very interesting because when I first heard of it, I was like, oh, it's the people that are on the front lines fighting for the movement, which is correct. But I think that to kind of give it a more clear definition is frontline communities are composed of Black, Indigenous people of color who have been historically oppressed and actively are oppressed in these systems that we live in today. And it's composed of a variety of individuals, whether it be queer, trans, non-binary folks, people who are disabled, people who are undocumented, people who are imprisoned, frontline healthcare workers. And so these types of communities, people are the ones that are the most affected by the climate crisis. And so when we talk about, well, who's being harmed by climate change? Is it the animals? It's everyone. It's animals and humans. And so I think that to give a picture for people to understand, like what happened in Hurricane Katrina back in 2005 or 2006, I believe, that was an environmental injustice because the community had a lack of support for infrastructure. And due to historic systematic racism of redlining, this also led to the harm and death of a lot of community members in that city. And so to be specific about frontline communities, I think it's an important tool for people to understand that we talk about these people because these are literally humans that have been cultivating cultures that have been fighting against environmental injustices, but then lose their lives to these horrific climate events due to climate change.
Really well said. Thank you for unpacking that for us. And I think I'm glad you brought up Katrina, in that I think it's a powerful example of, like, as you said, how environmental catastrophes don't hit everyone equally. And that's kind of the point. That's something we ought to not look away from as a society. I think that's something, not to go into too much of a tangent, but I think that's something the movie Parasite did really well. Is obviously mm-hmm. that movie did a lot of things incredibly well, but it showed you, you know, the example of the flood at the end of it. It showed you how for the rich family, the rainstorm was a minor inconvenience that messed up their camping trip. But for the poor family who was working class, it flooded their home and it's totally upended their world, their whole neighborhood. And so moments like that, I think that's what good art can do, is make us actually think, oh wow, like how have I not been thinking about climate and class, even these intersections we might not pay attention to otherwise.
Exactly. Yep. I think these are, of course, too, like as mentioned, like all of us have privileges and sometimes we're not aware of these things. And so how do we become actively aware and challenging ourselves to understand our privileges and our role in this movement?
Yeah. You know, in terms of through lines, you speak out very candidly on your Instagram. I admire you for that. You know, you've spoken out, for example, about white supremacy and veganism. And honestly, this is something I did not know about as I saw this post. And so can you help us understand, you know, how does racism manifest itself in veganism? This is something folks might not, be aware of. I'd love to learn a bit more about.
Yeah. So, you know, veganism itself, its roots is presented as coined in the 1940s by Donald Watson. And that's not to say that was the beginning of what veganism is, because many Black Indigenous people of color communities have always had deep, rich roots with plant-based systems. And so meat or non-human animals that were introduced to different types of environments through the colonization of meat kind of embedded themselves into part of their lifestyle and their diet. And so this is why we see so much heavy emphasis in non-human animal consumption. But the thing about white supremacy and veganism is the fact that animal activists, those who solely focus on animal liberation and do deny that it's an interconnected movement with human and non-human animals, say that the issue is human supremacists that have caused the mass murder of animals. While it is true that we've all contributed to forms of harming animals, whether it be our consumption of meat, whether it be our tax dollars going to these dairy industries, I think it's important to note that the rise of agribusiness industries and factory farms were products of colonization, were products of the development for society for a greater good. And as many mentioned, you know, people who were behind the agribusiness industry are generally white men that were involved in this. And so the argument that I've always mentioned is the fact that we cannot say that colonization is something in the past and it no longer exists. We have to address that if we were trying to, what you would call, end animal murderers and also liberate our undocumented farm workers who have to work in those fields, then we also need to dismantle these types of industries that are known to uphold white supremacy, because a lot of communities throughout the world never had factory farms. And this is something that is spread across these countries now, and it's normalized in society. And so for me, I think that I've had this such large conversations and such disagreements with a lot of people saying that it's humans' fault. And racism itself is something that they shouldn't focus on. They acknowledge it, but it's a global issue. But to be able to opt out of those conversations, to even say that it does not really reconcile or interconnect with your work, is a form of privilege itself. And it does not matter if you're a white person or not, because Black, Indigenous people of color can also uphold their privileges. And so I think, for me, you know, when I made that post about white supremacy and veganism, it angered so many people because it seemed as if a radical left agenda had entered the mainstream animal rights movement, and that I was hired by the dairy industry to market these messages. And so I think it's important that we have more thorough and direct conversations to be specific about what exactly happened and what created these dairy industries that we see today.
Wow. What did that feel like, you know, when you got that type of backlash? I mean, I think for a lot of folks that make a living in content, that would seem really threatening and kind of overwhelming to have people come at you like that.
You know, it was met with a lot of hate. It was met with a lot of DMs in my inbox. You know, there's a difference between hate messages and death threats, right? I completely understand as everyone gets hate messages. That's a difference. But there is a fine line between actually threatening to take someone's life because of their views, rather than saying, I disagree with you, whatever, right? And so I think it's important that language itself is very important, because our language can influence those to liberate themselves, but also people who perpetuate white supremacy and uphold it, their language, although they don't want to hurt anyone directly, can fuel extremists in this movement to further inflict violence. And we've seen this with rhetorics of eco-fascism, where, you know, white supremacists have been very influenced by this type of saying that immigrants take natural resources, and in order to clean the earth or to purify it, they must get rid of these people, this ethnic group. And so this is what the implications of language is that if we are not addressing for what it is, then we are going to allow other extremists to take advantage of this movement and to further cause harm. Doesn't matter if you're not the one causing harm. I understand they don't have intents, but language is very powerful, but it's also very dangerous.
Wow. So not to dwell too much on the negative here, but when people were, you know, you brought up basically veganism has a race problem. And so the people that were sending you threats and mean messages, what were they upset about in the statement veganism has a problem around racism?
They were upset because they believe that it was diluting the messages. It was deflecting the huge issue of human supremacy, and that, you know, it was dividing the animal rights movement. However, on top of that, during that time, there was a lot of comparisons of traumatic historical events being used, most especially the Holocaust, being used to describe the murder of animals. And while some people agree with that language and some people disagree, language matters. And as I mentioned previously, like, if you have a large following and you're perpetuating this type of comparisons, just because you don't want to harm anyone, which is fine, doesn't mean that's going to influence others to cause their own type of harm, whether it be through locally or institutionally.
That's really fascinating. Wow. So it sounds like, yeah, people found that you're being too controversial, and that, like, essentially by talking about the people in veganism, you're taking away from the understandable animal suffering that a lot of people would rather talk about or kind of rally around. Is that right?
Definitely. Yep.
Huh. Wow. That is wild. And people sent you threats about it, like death threats?
Yep. It's so horrifying. I actually, I took a day off social media because I was like, I just need to, like, get away from this. It doesn't really matter. I just need to, like, disconnect for a bit.
I feel you 1,000%. I would have probably taken a week or a year off after something like that. That sounds really intense. I mean, I guess flipping veganism to perhaps greener, more positive pastures, you know, I think a lot of folks are feeling plant curious these days, even non-vegans. I think lately, something about 2020 and all the disruptions, people are rethinking diet. What advice do you have for people that are thinking about eating more plant-based, but they're worried about maybe missing something or not it not being tasty?
You know, I think that it's important that, you know, there's so much rich flavors out there in the world. And I think that we're so exposed to very few here in the United States, unless we actively partake in different types of cultural foods. I think there's, you know, clinically and research has said that eating more plants and vegetables is good for the planet, for your body, and for the less contribution of suffering to animals and humans. But I think that what people sometimes really disregard is the fact that plants themselves carry so much more nutrients than non-human animal meat. And so I tell people to always do their research of what they have, right? I know that there's different allergies, there's different types of bodies. There's also, you know, not wanting to trigger any eating disorders or anything like that, because I'm not a mental health expert. But I do tell people that if you're going to go plant-based and eat more plant-based options, that you actively search and ask yourself, like, what are you currently eating right now? And does that suffice for what you are? Or if you are someone that may be afraid of lacking of certain things, you can also buy vitamins in case you're not going to get, as one being vitamin B12. It can be found in kale and other plants, but it's also important to also get that vitamin if you need it. And sorry, I meant nuts, not kale. But I think that when I tell people about going plant-based, it's about reducing what they can of their consumption of meat while actively trying to divest from these extractive industries, especially the dairy and farm, dairy and agriculture industry.
Yeah. You know, I think a common criticism, or I guess pushback some people have about going vegan is they say, oh, it's too expensive, or it's going to be too difficult. Like, how do you respond to people that tell you stuff like that?
Yeah. You know, this is actually interesting because I had the same misconceptions. I was a college student that was like, it's expensive. I think it is fair to say that vegan processed food is expensive.
Yeah.
I think it's also fair to say, though, that sub-vegan processed food is almost the equivalent to buying meat processed foods. So it's actually almost the same price these days, because the market for sustainability and ag products and plant-based products has injected itself in the market, that there's a huge demand now, that it's lowering the cost. And so I think that when people said, like, you know, it's expensive, you know, if you're able to afford non-human animals, you're able to afford, you know, fruits and vegetables, it certainly isn't. I think that there's also a lack of investment for people to learn new recipes, because I don't know anyone in my life that ate meat every day. I really don't. Maybe max five times a week.
Yeah.
But I did not know anyone who ate meat every day. And so I think, you know, the idea that veganism is expensive is also rooted in the fact that how we glorify it online, because we have these pretty pictures of people holding their vegan burgers or, like, you know, fries. But realistically, vegans don't really eat that every day. Like, maybe some do, but I don't eat that every day. I actually sometimes make soup or, you know, sandwiches. Like, you know, it's not really anything too fancy. So really trying out different types. And also it's an investment, because at the end of the day, meat products actually expire at a shorter time than plant-based products. So if you're investing in one, it's not going to expire as quickly. You're wasting more money when your food goes to waste. And I think that's something Imperfect Produce actually preaches about, reducing food waste, you know?
Totally. Yeah. The most expensive ingredient is the one you throw away every time. Yep. I appreciate you drawing that distinction for us, that it is not that going vegan is expensive. It's that eating processed vegan products is expensive, for the same reason that eating other processed foods can be expensive, because processing by definition costs money and time. So of course they have to make that up somehow. I think that's, you know, one of Michael Pollan's more interesting points is our food system is so commodified that how do you recap, you know, when food gets so devalued, how do the companies get that value back? Well, then they have to add value by processing. So, you know, selling potatoes is not very profitable. Selling potato chips is very profitable, or, you know, potato patties or potato crisps, you know, you can turn a potato into a million things these days. But no, that's a really important point, that it's, I think when you're thinking about value, you have to think about what type of food are you eating? Is it highly processed vegan food? Is it, you know, just fruits and vegetables and nuts? And I really like that you're pushing folks to ask those questions. Are there any books or movies that have strongly shaped your approach to environmentalism?
You know, I actually read Michael Pollan, his research in college, so I was very aware. I think for me, what helped me understand was that there was a book, I forgot the author's name, but it's a green book that says something about animal agricultural industry and the meat industry. I forgot who the author was, but in this book, he basically talks about how, you know, the food systems we see today were never really designed to actually feed us. It was actually rather to poison us and to, like you said, commodify and capitalize off our bodies, because they know, they work closely with the pharmaceutical industry and the medical industry. They know that low income people of color are going to be at the doctor's office. They know that doctors are going to also advocate for these different types of lifestyle or these types of foods, or eat more meat, eat more dairy. So, you know, there's a lack of, you know, information that is available, but also to the fact that in this book, it mentioned the fact that most church foods or donated foods are very heavily processed. They have dairy and meat. It's not even nutritious. Like, none of the food that is given to some of these food banks is actually nutritious. Maybe the canned bean, maybe the canned soup, maybe the fruits and vegetables they give, but at the end of the day, most of it is processed foods. And so what are you supposed to do with processed foods and expect someone to be healthy? Like, it is food, right? It is food at the end of the day. People will eat it, but it's not healthy. And so why are we spending so much tax dollars on subsidizing these corporations and these businesses that continue to put out unhealthy foods for low-income BIPOC communities? Yeah. And if we really want to create more equitable food systems, then we need to challenge the way that we fight these industries, because it was never broken. It was just designed in a way to just capitalize off of people.
Hmm. Yeah, that's the million-dollar question right there. Why are we subsidizing such unhealthy food? That surfaces actually in a lot of these chats we do on the podcast in some way, shape, or form. It's kind of the background. That's the key question, I think, for a lot of us to ask. I think you've kind of brought up actually my next question, which is, when we get into these thorny issues around the environment and food, I think a lot of us feel this sense of overwhelm or kind of crisis burnout. You know, you've spent a while getting people to get past that. So I'd love to hear, when you talk to somebody that's feeling just overwhelmed about something like climate change or racism or maybe the intersection of the two, how do you get them to move past overwhelm and towards action?
I always tell people to confidently engage in one thing they truly feel aligned with. And that means that you don't need to be an activist. You don't need to be an educator. You don't need to be an influencer. You don't need to be a writer. You can be anything that you want to be. But what you do need to be known of is you need to actively be aware of these issues while very confidently engaging in that one subject. Because once you're into that field or into that subject, then you'll start to see those interconnections, like how that connects to the main work you're doing. And so when people come to me and like, I'm so confused, help, I tell them environmentalism is not something that you learn in a day. It's something that is learned over historical timeline or intergenerational movement. Because at the end of the day, my environmental knowledge that I had when I was 18 to 24 has massively grown. And it's probably going to massively grow from 24 to 50. Who knows where I'll be during that time. So I always tell people that you should have growth mindset to learn about these topics, but also to have boundaries with yourself and be kind to yourself when you need to not opt out, but to take a break from this, because it's so much information. You're being thrown so much data. You're being thrown so much things. But as long as you confidently engage in what you really are passionate about, it'll make sense, because it'll start to click in your head through interconnections. But that takes time, and you can't blame yourself if you're not learning it within a day, because it took me months and years. Like, I, you know, still I'm learning, but it took me, you know, 6 years post-grad to create Curbbound Vegan. Like, I was not really thinking about this. I had understood what it meant, but I never really understood like how to have these conversations with people.
Absolutely. I appreciate what you brought up about historical timescale. I think, you know, not as a way to say, oh, we should just settle and wait because it takes time. Obviously, I think your work speaks to the importance of having a sense of urgency, but it's important to remember that these things do take time to change. You know, the EPA was established in the early 70s, right, by a Republican administration. And it's important to remember, like, a lot of this stuff is recent. Like, in you, as you brought up in your own work, you only added this kind of gender racial lens to environmentalism a couple of years ago. So yeah, it's important to cut ourselves some slack and remember that, you know, we're doing our best. It does take time, and that you do it, you have to build on what the generation before you did. And that's kind of all we can do, right?
Yep, definitely. And I think it's, as you mentioned, this is an intergenerational movement. Yeah. And we should not always place the faith on younger generations to fix it, but to acknowledge that we are all in this together and we will actively fight for our planet, because no one deserves to live in an unhealthy environment. No one does.
Absolutely.
So that's something that I think we can all agree on as human beings.
Totally. Yeah. And it's just, it's fascinating once you think about it the way you've talked about, because yeah, for it's interesting when you take the historical lens, you realize how much we take for granted that was new for our parents. For example, like the EPA, like they didn't grow up with a government agency responsible for the environment, and now it's an entrenched thing. Imagine, you know, for future generations, what will they take for granted that wasn't there when we were working, struggling, and stressing out about a lot of this stuff? You know, hopefully they will inherit a lot of things that we do not yet have. You know, the tools that have not yet been built. Gotta have faith. Well, I feel like we could go on and on about environmental issues, but I do want to be respectful of your time. I'd love to get to the speed round here and just hit our quick closer questions. The first one is really dovetails nicely, actually, with what we were just talking about, which is, what do you think folks should follow up with on their own time after listening to this episode?
You know, I think folks that want to get more involved in learning about environmentalism should follow organizations that are out there already doing environmental education, like the Slow Factory, Intersectional Environmentalists, Earthrise.studio, Future Earth. These organizations are like climate clubs. Like, these actually teach you so much more than what I put out there. But I think it's really important that you expand your knowledge of how you learn, because these organizations have free resources to expand it, and you don't need to pay a single dollar to learn about it. And two is also having these conversations with your loved ones, because I'm not asking people to change the system within a day or a year. I'm asking them to at least look within their own family members and be like, hey, we need to talk about the climate crisis. How is it affecting our neighborhood? How is it affecting our love life? How is it affecting our family relationships? What is the future for our children? Hmm. Because at the end of the day, parents can agree too that they love their children in some ways, and they would not want them to grow up with different experiences than they did growing up.
Yeah. Well said. What's a positive change you've made in your life in the past year you think folks should try?
You know, I think one of the positive change that I've done is to really admit my mistakes a lot of the times. I'm not perfect. I've realized that I've made so many errors in my work. I've made so many things that could have been done differently, but I think it helped me challenge myself to be a better person. And I think that we all can be better people. We all can challenge ourselves to do better, but it's going to be an uncomfortable truth. And so this is something that I tell people, is that we need to have these rough conversations, because if not, who's going to do it? Especially with our family members.
Yeah.
Our family members, sometimes, as much as we love them, they're not perfect. We know that. And this is sometimes a great time to have these discussions to actually change their mind, because you lead with the heart, not lead with rage. And so that's something that I always tell people to make sure that they do.
100%. That's actually one of our values internally at Imperfect, is lead with heart. I love that you brought that up. That's great. No, it's important. And that, not to put too fine a point in it, but that's something a lot of our guests have brought up, actually, that if you want to make change, you got to lead with the heart and the generosity. Not even if you feel really angry about an issue, it's rare you're going to reach people if you just come at them with the anger. It has to be this broader, like you said, compassion and generosity. I really appreciate you bringing that up. If you're cooking for somebody and you want to make them feel loved, what are you going to make for them?
You know, for me, I recently found out how to make vegan conchas. And so I'm a huge baker. Like, I really prefer baking than cooking. I also love cooking. But I think with baking, I feel like it helps me really be careful with what I'm doing, my environment. It makes me more aware. It makes me feel my own memories of growing up. And so when someone's sad in my life, I usually bake for them, because times like that, when you share that rich food with them, you get to see their face and their expression of how they try your food, but also this kind of opens them up to lead them to a conversation of like, you know, this has been happening in my life. And I think sharing those memories of food with people, to me is something that I hold so much deeper than I would have ever imagined growing up. And I didn't realize the importance of baking and cooking when I was younger. It was more like, get the job done and go. It was more, now I take the time to genuinely appreciate myself and those around me, because life is obviously limited, but the moment that you are living in this experience is the most memorable time in your life.
Wow, very poignant. Well said. What ingredient could you not live without?
That's a really good question. I think for me, the one ingredient I would not be able to live without is probably flour, because I make bread, I make a lot of baked goods and also other things. And so for me, it provides a staple food and it's really easy to make on my hand. I know it takes a lot of time to make, but for me, that's one of the staples that I really love, that I can't really miss.
Awesome. And what's your least favorite thing to waste?
My least favorite thing to waste, I would say, is that the almond pulp. So whenever I make plant-based milks, I always get pulp. And sometimes I want to throw them away because I'm like, I don't really need this. But then I realize that it's so important to upcycle your food in different ways. And so sometimes I use it for bakeries or for, you know, baking goods, or with oat pulp, I make oat cookies. And, you know, it takes more time, but I promise you, you'll be so much happy knowing that you didn't throw that food away. But also you shouldn't shame yourself if you did, but we all do, you know, no one's perfect.
Yeah. We're all imperfect when it comes to preventing waste, but with almond pulp, what can you do with it? You said you bake with it.
Yeah, you can use it as part of, I think when I make cookies, you can just add it too. Sometimes use for a flour, or even it can just be as a, I guess like ingredient to like hold the dough together. It's not really like good, to be honest. It's just an added supplement. But for me, I'm still working it out how I can incorporate it with better recipes, but I think it's better than not than throwing it out.
Totally. I know upcycling is great. You know, I ask in part because we sell cookies that are imperfect that are made with okara flour, which is like a byproduct of the tofu and like soy milk process. So I'm always curious to know about all of these other supply streams, whether it's almonds or oats. Like it seems like anytime we're processing them, there's something we could be doing with the leftover pulp, but you gotta have that know-how.
Yeah, definitely. You can also do it, add it to like oatmeal too on top of it if you want that extra amount. I mean, it's endless. That's the beauty about imperfect produce and food waste, is that you can just upcycle it to whatever you desire.
Totally. What is your go-to karaoke song?
This is such a good one. I'm trying to think about a song, but I think I'm very into the old music. I think the 90s or 80s. I call it old, but it's probably recent, to be honest. There's a band I think called, I'm trying to think, but if I had to think commonly right now, I would say like artist I really love her music. Her name is Callie Uchis. She's a really empowering artist, and I think her music is great. But if I think about that song, maybe I'll add it back in.
Awesome. How do you spell the artist name again?
Yeah, Callie, K-A-L-I, and then U-C-H-I.
Ah, perfect. Callie Uchi. Fantastic. We'll throw a link to her stuff in the show notes. Who's somebody you admire tremendously, and what do you admire about them?
You know, I would say the person I admire the most is my sister, because she really taught me to critically rethink the way that I would talk about things or learn about things, and really use critical discourse and use intersectionality to really implicate and to understand these systems of oppression. So for me, looking up to her, she's been a really huge role model in the way I became vegan too, in the way that I've navigated my career choices, in the way that I've navigated this field. And so having her as a huge supporter today, empowering me when I first created Queer Bound Vegan, is really amazing. It's kind of like a proud parent, I guess you can say, since she's way older than me.
That's wonderful. And finally, what are you grateful for this week?
You know, what I'm grateful for this week is actually getting my desk finally. I recently moved and ordered a desk, but it was delayed with the COVID delays, which is completely understandable. But now I'm excited to set up my desk and do more work.
Fantastic. It's the little things, I think, especially in these times. Yeah, having like a comfortable space to work from pays huge dividends.
Yep.
That's awesome. Isaias Hernandez, thank you so much for joining us today. This has been a really great conversation. Where can folks learn more about you and the work that you do?
Yeah, you can connect with me on LinkedIn at Isaias Hernandez, or check out my website at www.queerboundvegan.com. I have a free eco educational book, free download. You don't need to sign up anything for it. Feel free to use it, distribute it as much as you want, and also follow me on any types of social medias with the same handle. I'm everywhere you could say online.
Fantastic. And we'll throw the links to everything we talked about today in our show notes that'll live on our content site, thewholecarrot.com. So definitely check out thewholecarrot.com. That's where this podcast episode and all of our podcast episodes live. Isaias Hernandez, thank you so much. This has been a real pleasure.
Yeah, thank you too, Riley.